Station number 26588.
Alec Wingrave, Reel 3. What about cinema and sports?
You seldom had the opportunity of getting a pitch for sport. You seldom got a football pitch because there were so many ships in commission in those days that when you went to Gibraltar for it, as I reckon it was a year wait to get a football pitch at Gibraltar. It was really funny because they were always booked in by the locals.
We're talking about when you were in the Argos, are we?
Well, you could get a pitch ashore there in Scotland because we were mostly running from Scotland, and you could usually get a pitch there. But what was the other thing?
Cinema.
Cinema. I think we had a cinema on board, but I don't think I ever went to it. It wasn't a cinema as such, it was a mess deck clearance, and they just rigged up a temporary acting cinema stand and a sheet for to put onto. But the bigger ships, of course, than the newer aircraft carriers did have accommodation for that.
What about shore leave when you're in the Argos?
If you was in Greenock, we used to go up to in the Clyde, and if you were there, sometimes you'd be in there 2 or 3 days, and so there was shore leave all the time then. But it was dicey because you had drifters that had to come out because there was nowhere to accommodate a ship as big as Argus in Greenock or Gourock, and so she laid off in the centre of the river, and you had to go ashore in drifters, and civilian manned drifters, and they have certain times to bring you back aboard. So it was, you got leave whenever the commander felt like piping it.
And what did you do?
Well, went ashore. Usually a school pal of mine was on there, and he was courting a girl in Greenock, and so he used to take me up with him, and we might go to the pictures or we'd go to the canteen. There wasn't a lot to do in Greenock, just cinemas and no life theatre, and there was one naval canteen. So there wasn't a lot to do, and of course everything was blacked out anyway.
Do you have any particular memories of anybody who served with you in the Argos?
Only the chap that I went to school with, and we were sort of good pals. We went to school at the same time, same class, and then joined the same cycling club together. And he worked in the oh dear, in the city. Anyway, he was quite well up in. Who did he work for?
Was this after the war or
No,
before?
this was before the war. Yeah, he was a year younger than me, I think. Where it's all finance,
Stock exchange.
stock exchange. That's where he worked. And so when the commander saw his papers, he took him as commander's writer, because only the captain has a writer in a ship of that size, a listed writer. That's his trade. So he grabbed Don as his writer, the commander did, and he came down to the cabin one night, and Don and I were sitting in there writing letters, and he looked, and I was in a white suit, which I shouldn't have been after 4 o'clock, as I was off duty, and he said, "Hello, hello, what's this?" And Don said, "Oh, we went to school together." So, "Oh," he said, "that's nice for you." He said, "Enjoy it." And he walked away. He wasn't bothered. But he could have been funny about it, I suppose. So Don and I, every time, he didn't do duties. So every time I was off duty, if he wanted to go ashore, we went together. as he was commander's writer, he was excused duties.
So you were in the Argos for about 15 months?
No, only 5 months.
5 months,
yes,
sorry.
Yeah. Yes, and then we... The next time we went back to Arbroath, to HMS Conder, and we were there about a couple of 3 months, doing more training with these new pilots. And then we went back to Argos, and the chief buffer said to me, the captain thinks you don't need two cooks to go to Argos. He said, so we're going to send you to Landrow, because he needs another cook, really, because he wasn't fully staffed. It was still being built, the one at Campbelltown. And so instead of going there, the chief buffer came to me and said, would you like to fly to Campbelltown? I said, yeah. I said, I'd soon fly to Campbelltown and go by lorry. And it took 2 hours. We flew from Arbroath to Campbelltown. And I did that twice. When the ship's company went to Argos, I went to Landrail instead. So I enjoyed that, and that's where I met the wife.
And what was Landrow?
Landrow was another air station, the same as Conder, HMS Landrow. It was 5 miles from Campbelltown, and it's still open as an airport, naval airport now.
How long did you serve there?
Well, only 2 months at a time. Three times I was there for 2 months. And it rained most of the time I was there. Yeah.
You met your wife at this stage?
Yes, yes. I met her the first time we went there. And of course we used to correspond after that. And I used to go to our main galley. And she used to ring me up at night from Campbelltown once a week. Without the knowledge of the boss man, of course. And then after, we met in June, and we were married in the December, same year, just under 6 months.
When you married, I mean, by the end of 1941, were you still alternating between the Argos and...
No, I didn't go to the Argos again. No, only Conder and Landrow. For me. And the other chef went to the Argos each time.
And what happened to you after your period of shore based?
Oh, I passed for leading hand in Conder with flying colours, actually. And when I picked my leading hand rate up, which is the same as a corporal in the Army or Air Force, I was there about 6 weeks. And they piped for me at the, pardon me, they piped for me at the drafting office. And when I went down there, they said, you're to return to barracks, Portsmouth. So that was it. And I was there back in Portsmouth for about a month and got drafted to a corvette, HMS Spey. She was a river-class frigate. And I got drafted to that at Londonderry.
HMS Bay.
S-P-E-Y. It's a river in north of Scotland. They were all named after rivers, this class. And I wasn't very happy with that because I got aboard at 7 o'clock one night and we sailed for Freetown at 6 o'clock the next morning, which was a 28-day trip. And we were a fortnight in Freetown and then 28 days back again.
Being on a corvette must have been very different from your previous experience.
Yes, it was.
In what way?
Well, they rolled on wet grass. They were that bad, you know. They were flat-bottomed. See, all these corvettes and frigates were flat-bottomed. So they wasn't very comfortable ships. And they were overcrowded. We commissioned with 145. When I got aboard, there was 145 crew. And by the Christmas, there was 165. And we'd had all sorts of new equipment put on board, which needed more men. So we went from 145 to 165.
So what did that mean for your living conditions?
Oh, terrible. We were packed like sardines. And of course, it was more difficult for the cooking because we only had the same accommodation and the same facilities for doing the cooking.
How many cooks were there for a quarter?
Only myself and a young cook that had just finished his training. He just got aboard there before I did. And he wasn't very good either. He came from a merchant navy background. His naval time, his sea time was up and down the North Sea in tramp steamers. And he wasn't particularly healthy.
So no petty officer cooks?
No, I was in charge. And then eventually I got rid of him. And the chap that took his place was an apprentice cook in an Oxford university, which was, he was well trained and a really good cook. So we got on very well. And without anybody's any asking anybody else, I said to him, right, I said, you're as good as me. So we work watch and watch. So he did a day and I did a day, which was much better. And we had to bake bread on board there, of course. After 3 days, we were baking bread. £160 of bread every day. We had to make doughs, which was a difficult job because I had a coxswain who was very tight with the... what is it that makes the bread swell? Yeast. Very tight with the yeast. 2 ounces of yeast he used to allow me with... for £160 of bread. So you have to make 6 hour doughs. So we had to make a dough at 6 o'clock in the morning and take it at 12 o'clock, which wasn't very comfortable. And I used to ruck him, but I didn't get anything out of it. When I left there, we were still doing that. So eventually, another leading hand came aboard. And, the coxswain came in and said, one of you two's got to go back to barracks. So I said, that's me. And I went back to barracks and left the other two on board. And
What sort of facilities did you have at your disposal on a corvette?
What sort of?
Facilities, cooking facilities.
One range, about as long as that recess. One cooking range. It had a boiling water tank behind it, which you had to keep boiled. And The engineer wasn't a very comforting fellow. He was RN. He was the only RN officer on board. And he said to me once, if you have any more improvements in your galley, you can sit down in the mess and do the cooking from there. I said, well, if it's for the benefit of the boys, so be it. And we didn't get on all that well. But eventually, I did persuade him to put a steam pipe in from the main engines. And that steam pipe went into the water tank, so you could have boiling water in 2 minutes, which often people would stand there for 20 minutes waiting for the water to boil and make a pot of tea. You know, there was very little cooperation on there. It was a real mixed crew.
Who did you report to?
Well, each section on there had a routine officer. That he had a section that he looked after, and ours was an electrician. He was an electrician lieutenant electrician. So he didn't know anything about outside anyway, and you couldn't get much fun out of him. So as soon as they said one of you two have got to go back to barracks, I said that's me, and I was back in barracks, and a pal of mine that I knew. He was a leading hand when I joined. He said to me one night in the mess, why don't you volunteer for submarines? He said, I'm going back. He'd been in submarines for about 4 years. He said, I'm going back to submarines. He said, I couldn't stand this. So I volunteered. And next thing I knew, I was in the submarine base.
How long were you on the Corvette or in the Corvette?
A year and 5 months.
So that would take us from 1942
to 44. January 44.
1942.
However, the months sweat time, but that was it. About a year and 5 months. Yeah.
What were the duties of the corvette when you were? What was
Well, when I got the second fella, who was an excellent cook, we just did a day on and a day off. But both of us in the forenoon, in the galley together.
What was the corvette up to? What was her job?
Escorting convoys
across the Atlantic.
Across the Atlantic, twice I went across to Newfoundland, twice to Freetown, and then some weeks in the Mediterranean. We went in for the Mediterranean landings, the North African landings, to Algiers and Bougie. And we were in there a few weeks then. And then when we came back, we picked up another convoy and took that to Bougie, Algiers, Bougie, and Malta. And that was... We were escorting convoys up to 50-odd ships. And sometimes, I think the first trip, we had four or five corvettes and destroyers with us. But by the end of the year and 5 months, they were building them so fast then that it was nothing for us to go to sea with eight escorts. And, of course, we were causing a lot of damage to the German U-boats then. And
any particular incidents involving your corvette?
Yeah, we sank two. We had one that was a possible. But when we got in, the following time we were back in harbour, the skipper announced that we had sunk it, and then we did sink one. I had the dates, but I don't suppose you were interested in those, are you? The dates of...
Yeah.
No, of the sinkings, no, not really.
Well, if you've got them.
Yes. On convoy HX226, we sank U136 on the 11th of July 1942, and she was the one that was a possible, but it was confirmed that we had sunk her afterwards. And we sank U634 on the 6th of May 1942, and that was the big turnaround in the U-boat war. Dönitz recalled all his U-boats and fitted them with snorkel masts, which they could dive and run on diesels with a snort mast sticking out the top, so that they could get air in. And
who was the skipper of your corvette?
Commander Boyce Smith, B-O-Y-S hyphen Smith. And he's the chap who lived in Yule, a couple of streets from where my people did. But of course he was seldom home, because before the war apparently he was a pilot in the Mediterranean. But he was an excellent skipper. He had a set, and he had a piece that stuck out in the front. And if we were trying to ram, this piece used to stick out as well, with his head well forward. But he was a good captain and he knew what he was doing.
What were conditions like when you were doing the convoys?
Well, it depended where you went. You see, when we went to Freetown, from level with Gib, it was boiling hot all the way to Freetown, and Freetown was a terrible place. The leave then was 1 till 6, 1 o'clock at lunchtime till 6 o'clock at night, and that was it. And we were in two watches, so I could go ashore one day and my young chef could go ashore the next. But the ship's company were in three, so they could go ashore two out of one. But there was very little there. There was a canteen at King Tom Wharf, which sold Canadian beer, and you could only have two bottles. And 10 miles away was Lumley Beach, and you had mad coloured fellas that used to drive you to Lumley Beach for swimming and stay 2 hours and then come and pick you up and take you back. But there was nothing else.
How did you cope with the weather conditions, the climate?
Well, it was all right. It was immaculate. And there was a rule that was very strictly enforced that anybody found without a hat was automatically on 10-day stoppage of leave, because you quickly got sunstroke out there. It was so hot, Freetown. They called it White Man's Grave. It was a terrible area to be in. And then, of course, the alternative, it so happened that nearly it always happened that we'd do a Freetown convoy, and then we'd do one probably to Newfoundland, and it split between there and Russia, and we'd go back to Iceland. And I think on board the lads were more scared, pardon me, more scared of the icebergs than they were of the Germans. Yeah, they were pretty ribby, because you could see icebergs everywhere, and of course we knew that 3/4 more were beneath the surface than we could see. So we were glad to get come further south from that.
What about the cold?
The cold, we used to put more and more jumpers on. And in the galley, our galleys were on the upper deck. We used to work in there with perhaps 3 jumpers and 2 overcoats on the upper deck. It was so cold. And of course, we had a problem with the bread making as well, because people don't realise in England, the bakers use the same temperatures all the time. But we used to have, off Iceland, you had to use boiling water, almost boiling water, as hot as you could bear your hands in to mix the dough, because it was all handmade doughs, of course. And at Freetown, you was using ice water. And when you talk to bakers about it in the UK, they can't believe it, because it never affects them. The bread making was one of the difficult parts of it. And we never ran out of yeast, fortunately. But our longest patrol was 28 days. That was to Freetown. It was 28 days to Freetown and 28 days back. That was to Liverpool or Londonderry.
You were married by this time?
Yes, I was married in December 41. Yes.
How did you cope with the separation from your wife?
Well, we weren't very happy about it, naturally, because of the parting. But then she had our son in 43. So she left the Wrens, of course, and went to live with my parents. Because her parents were still living in Scotland, and she's Scottish, of course. And so she preferred to go south, because there was better accommodation. We had quite a big house in Yule, and she lived with my parents from then onwards until the war ended. And then we lived in Portsmouth and then Havant. And we stayed in Havant until I was demobbed.
Were you able to see much of each other during the period that you were in the corvette?
Not really. I think three leaves I had in the corvette, which were never more than sort of 8 to 10 days. They were boiler clean leaves, we call them. You had to clean the boilers every so often. So that was it. And then you had every other leave. When we came into Londonderry or Liverpool, one half of the ship's company would go and leave, and the other half would stay aboard for the boiler clean and the rest of what had to be done on board. And then the next time we came back, the opposite leaves, the opposite watches would go. But
were you ever seasick?
I was seasick the first 2 days I was on board that corvette. Yes. After that, I was never seasick again, and never seasick in a submarine. No. I was fortunate, I suppose, in that, because some people were seasick continuously. Terrible. I wouldn't have liked the Navy if I'd have been like that. Yeah.
So you volunteered for submarines?
Yes, I did.
What happened after that?
Well, I just stayed in submarines until I was demobbed. From 44, I was drafted to various submarines. About 6T class and 2S class boats I served in, two of them twice, and to me it was a doddle. I really enjoyed submarines because the biggest crew was 64, and so it was like cooking for mum at home, you know. It was so easy, and the boys appreciated it.
Once you'd volunteered for submarines, what happened to you then?
Well, we had about 3 months training, submarine training, and
what did that involve? And where going, was that?
That's in Portsmouth, going in Gosport rather, across the water, which was the submarine base, and we had a 25-foot escape tank there that you used to have to escape from during the training.
Can you describe that?
Well, it was a tank as big as the walls were from that wall to this wall, and but round. So, and it was 25 foot deep, and you'd go in with your swimming trunks on, and a Davis escape tank set, which you wore here, and it had a oxygen bottle in the bottom. Everybody had to do that, and you were supposed to do it every 6 months. But I only did it twice more in 10 years. So they didn't bother about it a lot, because there were very few people that were able to escape from submarines. If a submarine was hit, it was hit. And you went down with all hands, which my cousin did, and of course he's still down there. There was very few boats that were damaged and sank, and people got out of them. Very few.
What else did your training involve?
Well, there wasn't anything else.
You said it lasted for 3 months. Presumably, yes. It wasn't cooking training.
Oh, no, but it was all to parts of ship. Everybody had to do part of ship in a submarine. You had about three or four jobs. Mostly, I was sight setter on the gun, 4-inch gun. But on one boat, I was Tommy gunner, which I wasn't very pleased about that, because you had to take the Tommy gun up with you, up the control room, the control tower, onto the bridge for Tommy gunner. But we had a diving position, a servicing position, which was the same. Two or three different jobs you had to do. Everybody in the submarine could more or less do everybody else's job. That was part of the training, that we were on training submarines for 3 months. Well, we're in the school for a couple of weeks, and then you went to sea more or less every day, and you were given jobs to do, so that you knew what all the boat's jobs were. You had different positions in the boat, that where tanks were open and tanks were closed, and you had to be able to do it more or less everybody else's job. All the electrics you had to do, you had to be able to control the submarine speed and diving and what have you. But of course you didn't do the WT, the wireless, you didn't touch the wireless. You wasn't allowed to start or stop the engines. That had to be an ER, an engine room officer, or a petty officer or a chief petty officer stoker. Nobody was allowed to start or stop the engines. I had one captain that he used to love to do this. If we had visitors on board, and they were usually senior officers from other services, he'd look along the galley in harbour, of course. He'd look along the galley and see if I was there, and he'd call me. He'd say, "Can you give me a minute, chef?" That was a name they always gave you in the boat, chef. So I'd go along, I'd say, "Yes, it won't be a minute, sir." I'd go along and I'd find the telemotor pressure had been turned off. He used to do this. And he'd say, "Raise the periscopes for me, will you?" And he'd look at the guests, and he'd say, "Now this is my cook. Everybody in the boat can do everybody else's job." This was one of his brags, which wasn't strictly true, of course. And I'd pull the lever up to raise the periscopes, and of course they wouldn't come up. So I'd say, "I'm sorry, sir, there's no telemotor press. I won't keep you a few minutes." And I'd turn the telemotor on, and they could hear it rattling away with power going into the system. And then after a couple of minutes, I'd switch that off and bring the periscopes up. And he used to be so pleased with this, the skipper. And you see, in the Army and Air Force, I mean, the cook was a cook, and he didn't do anything else.